Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Salzburg, Austria. Tonight's episode, our 18th, we call Pedagogy of the Compressed, where we talk about geography teaching practices that seek to produce spaces of democratic inquiry in a time-space compressed and globalized world. We're in Texas, California, and here in Austria. Stay tuned for the expedition. In this episode, we explore three sites: academia and university-level courses in human geography, a high school-level week-long field course where students upcycled bicycles and felt the rhythm of a California only experienced at 10 to 15 miles per hour, and finally, urban explorations in Salzburg, seeking out geographical themes on foot and doing geography. We call it Pedagogy of the Compressed, tipping our hat to Paulo Freire, the Brazilian educator whose work in critical pedagogy produced the classic Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Here we play with words a bit to highlight teaching methods, practices, and philosophies which engage with how the geographical imagination or spatial consciousness of people, and here our students, learning and developing their ideas in this globalized or time-space compressed world. Here we refer to the geographical concept that says the world is shrinking with advances in travel and communications like the internet or cell phones. Our world is closer. We are moving faster. Not only does this affect our imagination of the world, it poses challenges to how we access it. Tonight we want to open up the show's discussion of pedagogy. A former brewer, private investigator, and union organizer, Rich Heyman is a lecturer in the Department of Geography and the Environment at the University of Texas at Austin. He earned his PhD in geography from the University of Washington in 2004. His areas of interest are urban and cultural geography, critical theory, public space, and pedagogy. His work has appeared in numerous academic journals, and we asked him to join us to speak about learning spaces and their potential for the radical. He joins us from Austin, Texas, and we start by discussing academia and the balance between research and teaching, publishing in little red journals, and using the classroom as a place not just for expert lecturing, but for expanding the geographical imagination by doing geography.
The way in which we're sort of, acculturated as academics through our own experiences as undergrads or in grad school, the way that knowledge and teaching is talked about is that it's secondary to the production of knowledge, which it happens in the research realm, yeah. Right? So the research realm is primary knowledge production, and that teaching is somehow a more kind of passive dissemination of that knowledge. And that leads to, and that idea is connected to the ways in which we teach. So it's both reinforced by those ways we teach, and then those ideas then reinforce how we do teach. So, you know, if we, and those of us who are academics often excelled in traditional types of education where knowledge was presented in the classroom context as being this kind of inert object that we simply is passed from one person to another, almost like, you know, as a commodity or something like that. And that, you know, we people who ended up going to grad school were pretty good at doing that. Right. And they got good grades and ended up, you know, getting into graduate schools and wanted to teach, and then oftentimes kind of reproduce those those kind of same methods and models of teaching and just carry on with the certain assumptions about that secondary nature of knowledge production that is, you know, thought to be associated with the teaching endeavor. And for me, that, you know, there's been a pretty vigorous discussion in education circles and in studies of in people who talk about teaching and pedagogy, in either in education fields or in other areas of the academy, where there's historically been more discussion of teaching, of kind of alternative methods. And one of the people, one of the theorists of kind of a different approach to teaching is a Brazilian writer named Paulo Freire. And he talked about this kind of traditional model of education as where knowledge is sort of thought of as just being transferred from one person to another in a kind of inert way. And he called that the banking model of education, where kind of it's, you just kind of deposit your knowledge as the teacher into this empty vessel of the students. And that's, for Freire, that not only was reproducing this idea about knowledge, but it was inherently also about power relationships between
the expert,
a teacher and a student. Yeah, the expert who kind of was the person who knew all, and the student who knew nothing, who was filled with knowledge by the expert knower. And I think that that's a very condescending way to approach students, or to approach any people, right? Like people, especially when they're, you know, by the time they reach high school or college age, you know, even little kids, right? They have complex thoughts, they theorize, they deal with, you know, knowledge and data that's coming to them, inputs that they have, and to treat them as kind of, you know, empty vessels that need to be filled with our great thoughts is demeaning to them and kind of reproduces all sorts of power dynamics
right.
in our society that devalue
right.
certain people's knowledge and that value other people's knowledge. And it's kind of that way of thinking is, to me, kind of inherently undemocratic. So when I want to think about my students and my interactions with students as producing knowledge, it's definitely not in a kind of one-way flow from me to them, but you know, more as a kind of interaction among us as we exchange ideas, as we think through problems together, as I proffer new, you know, theories to them coming out of academia, and try to get them to interact with ideas that I am interacting with. But what I don't hope that the students do is merely exchange my ideas for their ideas,
right?
What I want them to do is kind of take what they know and where they're coming from and take what I'm bringing to them and see how those two things interact and be able to kind of deal with those two and consider them together and put them together with certain kinds of rigor in terms of thinking through, you know, arguments, thinking through how to deal with evidence, thinking through, you know, where knowledge comes from, where do we get this data from, and those kinds of questions, and not merely just trying to get them to accept what I tell them, but to get them to kind of think through and consider things that I think might, that for me kind of shed light on the world and help me understand the world. And, you know, I, of course, you know, on some level want to share that with the students and want people to kind of see the world like I do. But on another level, what I'm really hoping is that they consider what I have to offer, I consider what they have to offer. And through that interaction, you know, new knowledges are produced and new thinking is produced and the students are treated in a kind of respectful way that doesn't devalue where they're coming from, what they might already know, and who they are as people. It doesn't kind of, it treats them as autonomous humans.
Right. You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To find out more about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To give some feedback or suggestion for a future episode, go to the comments section on the website, or go to the blog and enter into the conversation. In these spaces that you're talking about, whether that's the space of the classroom or literally in the space of what you're sort of interrogating and discussing, you're dialoguing about this. I mean, do you think that they're, or do they think they're doing geography? I mean, is this active kind of way of doing geography, or do they really even go deeper than that and just kind of think, yes, we are a part of this knowledge production? I mean, are they grasping that? Are they appreciating that in some ways too? I mean, the way the dynamic, it sounds that you are working with in your classroom spaces or with your groups, wherever that may be. I mean, do they feel like, is there that empowerment of feeling like they are producing knowledge?
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
I try to also be like transparent with the students and tell them like why I might be approaching an issue in a particular way or why I might have set up an assignment in a particular way that I want them to think of themselves as being a researcher. I want them to think of themselves as, like you said, like doing geography rather than as merely, kind of remembering what somebody else has said. So I try to have the students do assignments and do projects in my classes where they take ideas from scholars or from other writers, and they use those ideas as the basis of a project where the students have to make arguments of their own. So just to give an example, I have students in an introduction to geography class, which is like a big lecture of 250 students. I have them read excerpts of a book that's all about National Geographic magazine. The book's called Reading National Geographic by Catherine Lutz and Jane Collins. And the book is a very critical examination of the way in which National Geographic magazine has historically portrayed the developing world.
Right.
And their argument is essentially that National Geographic has portrayed the developing world mostly through a lens of kind of racism and imperialism that National Geographic had kind of inherited from its founding around the turn of the 20th century. And what I ask students to do is consider this argument by Lutz and Collins. But what I really like about Lutz and Collins's book is that they have detailed readings of many photographs from the magazines. And they look specifically at the magazines from the years 1950 to 86, which is, you know, already 30 years ago.
Right.
And so I asked the students to take Lutz and Collins' argument, go back to the journal, go to the magazine, which there are online archives, or they could go to the library and browse them in print, and look through the magazines and see if they see the same patterns that Lutz and Collins saw, if they see something different, if National Geographic has changed. So they have to interact with, they have to take Lutz and Collins' argument seriously, but they don't have to merely blindly accept it. They don't have to come away from the class saying, yes, National Geographic did exactly what Lutz and Collins said, and that's the end of the story. The end of the story is, you know, that they were able to go to the journal, find evidence, see patterns, and then write a paper in which they make an argument in relation to Lutz and Collins' argument. So they're kind of producing new knowledge of their own about what's happening in National Geographic. And then hopefully they can then extend that to thinking about visual representations of the developing world and other media, and visual representations of geographies of all different kinds. So I try to get them to, you know, be rooted in this project, but then to also offer them examples of how that approach can get us to think about how other geographies are imagined,
right?
Not just how the developing world is imagined through National Geographic, but how we imagine many places through all kinds of visual and other kinds of media that we're, you know, bombarded with all the time. And so I try to offer them many examples. I try to get them to bring in examples to their discussion sections when they meet with their TA, so that they can broaden the discussion of what Lutz and Collins that was begun by interacting with this argument by Lutz and Collins. So, and then hopefully they can, when they leave the class, they're all kind of doing geography, analyzing images, thinking about them, not merely reproducing what Lutz and Collins said, but kind of thinking through the arguments over and over again, and maybe,
right,
you know, altering as they go through the world how they think about images and representations and how they imagine places and how those imaginations can affect our actions in the world towards different places.
Right. I mean, I think that's a great example of how our geographical imaginations are formed. National Geographic being, for so many people, like, just because they use the term geography, or, you know, a part of the term geography there, they almost have owned what geography is for very many years. And many academic geographers would argue, or most would argue, that's not really what we do in academic geography. It's part that,
mm-hmm.
but it is, yes, those images do and have sort of informed certain ways of thinking about the rest of the world. And I think entering into someone else's study and kind of rethinking it or redoing it, challenging it, and interpreting the study and then those images, that's quite interesting. And I think it's a great way to introduce the idea of, well, what is this imagination? Why do I think this about, you know, Zimbabwe? Why do I think this about Australia? Why do I think this? And it really kind of gets into a lot of bigger themes too, of like, I don't know, injustice and what kind of injustices, mm-hmm. around the world we're willing to kind of, you know, ignore, and what kind of injustices we're not. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is an hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. This public geography project presents a geographical or spatial way of thinking about our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. Each episode takes a theme, or perhaps a question, and explores it through an interactive dialogue with different texts and voices. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
I have with me on the line two members of the faculty of Sugar Bowl Academy and two students, seniors, who took part in a very special project last year. And I want them to to actually describe it for us a little bit. And I'm going to ask the teachers first to kind of walk us through the genesis or where the idea for this project came and how, in some ways, did you get your school support? How does your school function that allows for such kind of creative projects? Andy and Seth here are the faculty members from Sugar Bowl Academy. So how did it all start?
Sure. Well, thanks for having us, Kevin. This is a program at the high school here that happens every spring, and we've been doing this now for 4 years, and this coming May will be our fifth year, and we call it experiential education, and all students in the school from grade 8 to 12 engage in a week-long academic and experiential place-based experience that tackles a guiding question, and we spend the year in courses to study the focus of the trip, and then in May, we all embark on some sort of journey, and the one that we'll talk a little bit about today is this trip that the four of us had on bicycles, studying urban geography and Californian identity last May. I can start by saying our research question that we set back even a year ago would have been, what opportunities does a bicycle provide? And this blended a lot of my own personal interests in urban and cultural geography and bicycles. And Seth Dow, who is my partner in this, was able to bring in a lot of his personal interests and talents and even life, because we traveled through where Seth grew up on this bicycle trip.
So you pose a question a year ago, basically, and it's not to just then do a week-long experience. It's actually building up all throughout the year. It's kind of a theme throughout the year, right? It sounds like you're meeting regularly during the course of the semesters to discuss this question. Like, what is the preparation between, say, now or this time last year and what then became this week in May?
Yeah, I can touch on that. So I also wanted to touch on kind of the genesis of the project.
Of course, yeah.
I've done quite a bit of mechanics work on bicycles in college, and I'm the head of the math department here at Sugar Bowl, so I was looking for like a STEM type of trip for the students to take, and also one that would be, you know, kind of a big journey and feel like an accomplishment at the end. And the marriage of having a self-built bicycle and then taking that bicycle on a journey seemed to match both of those goals really well.
Wait, I'm going to stop you real quick, Seth, just because the listener at this point doesn't know that you actually built these bicycles. And I know that because I've had a conversation with you guys. You actually built the bicycles?
Well, I guess you couldn't say that we built them like from scratch, but we got a bunch of bicycles from a bike church or like a bicycle co-op in a nearby town, and we stripped all the parts off of them and had students stripped all the parts off and rebuilt all the parts.
Wow.
Back on the bicycle. They also painted it so that they had a bicycle that was unique to them and that they had chosen the style and design of the bicycle.
So completely personalized. And they, I could only imagine feeling a different kind of ownership over this bike because you've personalized it. And maybe, and we'll come back, Seth, I didn't mean to cut you off, but maybe I could get Hannah to come in and maybe talk about, okay, well, what color did you paint your bike?
So my bike, I painted it green with some blue, some elegant little blue stripes. But like you're saying about becoming more attached to the bike, that was definitely true. That made me smile when you said that, because we spent a whole winter and some spring working on these bikes, and it was frustrating at times because they were all these old used parts, and eventually we'd work and work and we'd finally get a gear to shift or a brake to stop the wheel from turning. And it was super accomplishing, and you definitely formed an attachment to this bike. You put so much into it.
And Brandon, what do you think about the, I don't know, just the whole process of piecing together your own bike and piecing together then, I don't know, the vehicle through which you're going to do this project, this experiential learning project?
We got to, I feel like we knew a lot more about the bikes. I mean, they definitely weren't in the best of shape when we went out to ride them, but I felt like we had spent so much time working on them that we had kind of a sense of security that if they were to break down, we just had like a much better idea on how to fix them up on the side of the road. And I definitely agree with Hannah that there was a sense of ownership over these bikes over really any other thing that I own.
And would you guys both say in terms of, you know, there's this idea of the ownership over the bike, and I don't mean that like it's mine. I mean, like you fixed it, you know how it works. Would you get a sense that that way of approaching this whole year-long project actually then made you think about the project itself, that you were much more a part of it? Do you think that trend, that sort of translated, or that the idea of actually making your bike then made you feel more part of the trip?
Yeah, that's a good point, because from the beginning of this trip, we weren't leaving out any details. We weren't just doing things kind of knowing what was going on. Like building the bike, we had to know how every single part worked because we put it back. So going into the trip, we weren't just riding through places and missing details or ideas. We were able to experience everything fully. So that was kind of the mentality we set up throughout the year.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Seth and I spent a lot of time trying to plan, looking at outcomes that we had hoped may have happened by the time this trip ended and the course ended. And the word that we really looked at to frame everything was the word slow. And that comes into some of the experiences that we set up that we can touch on in a bit. But the notion that we live in a place that there's a lot of outdoor adventure sports and people going fast, and this bike trip was a slow bike trip, and it was intentionally slow experience, and these bikes were incapable of going very fast, and they had their problems, and they were heavy, and they were slow, but because of that, it really pressured us to observe things differently, and to, throughout the entire winter, as Brandon and Hannah were talking about it, all of us, including Seth and I, upcycled these bicycles. We intentionally set a $100 benchmark on every bicycle, including the cost of the bike to begin with.
So you couldn't spend more than $100?
We didn't want to spend lots of money on these. We wanted to slow it down, to upcycle bicycles, learn bicycle mechanics, to then engage in this place-based study, and that was it. Just looking at how in all of our lives we're spending money, we're going fast, we're moving from place to place, eating at restaurants, shopping online, and how this was a chance for us to work with what we had and be creative and problem solve and figure out ways to make it happen. And I can remember with both Brandon and Hannah moments where we weren't sure that it was going to happen. And I can remember the first time that Brandon put his bike up to take the headset apart on a bike stand, and we realized at that point his bike was of an older vintage than most of them, because when he opened the headset, ball bearings just scattered across the workspace. And if anyone's worked on a bicycle today, their ball bearings are coming in a casing. So it comes as a unit. And Brandon looked up at all of us, and just the look on his face said everything. And what he's thinking is, I'm not sure this is going to happen. And that's part of the beauty of this upcycling project, and that's part of us setting the right mindset to then look at the CitySlow movement and look at the farm-to-table movement in California and look at the challenges that urban planners and urban geographers have faced and continue to face in cities where there is a reliance on the automobile and trying to push forward bike lanes and smart growth and new urbanism projects in a country that gobbles up gasoline more than most places in the world.
Yeah, so the Slow City, or CitySlow movement, and farm to table, could someone maybe explain a little bit what you were able to accomplish by, I believe you were able to look at the farms where food was produced and then see how it made it to market. Is that correct? And maybe, is this in Sonoma Valley?
Yeah, so I could start off with that, but I think that a variety of answers on this one would probably be beneficial to understanding what happened.
Yeah, please. So, yeah.
The farm-to-table movement, one of my friends from high school had, he developed a farm that was all horse-powered, or it was non-petroleum-based. So we spent one night with him at his farm. So we slept in a kale field. And we had a very inspiring talk with one of the farmers who basically not only gave us kind of a lecture about how slow food is to grow,
mm-hmm.
and the amount of work that takes, but also how when you live the lifestyle of a plant, how that shifts your understanding of time. And you very rarely, when you make a mistake or something changes that you don't expect, you don't get to correct it that year. You have to wait an entire year or growing cycle to.
Huh. So it's very much being in touch with like the rhythm of another species, or in this case, a plant, an edible plant, and trying to.
Right.
Really cool. Yeah.
And I think, you know, getting connected with that, seeing what a person has to do to be connected with plants and seeing that connection in general, you know, was a big learning outcome for us, because very few people get the opportunity to see where food is grown or how it comes to your plate or the type of people that are doing that and the care that it takes and what kind of lifestyle they live. You know, they all woke us up out there at 6:30 in the morning, you know, ready to boot up and go weed and water and, you know, move their seedlings and stuff like that. So yeah, that was the, I think, the main experience with the farm to table movement that we had with people.
And it's the process. I mean, like a good excursion like that to demystify the what's going on there, right? I mean, to really get students to see firsthand, even you can't even see that necessarily in a documentary. I mean, so it's getting in there and really seeing it. What did you guys think, Brandon and Hannah? I mean, where does sleeping with kale fit in on the cool scale? I mean, is this something that you'll remember going into university? Like, not just as a kind of unique opportunity, or do you see like some of those, you know, seeing the cycle of a plant and how that then creates a calendar and way of life for the one that produces, or the one that's there harvesting it, essentially?
I think it'll definitely be the memories I'll bring to like the university and later in life. I mean, it's just, We don't do anything really like that, especially up where we live. Farming just really isn't part of life. So to be down into a place where a lot of like organic, natural farming is happening, and we have to just really enjoy it and see it for what it is.
Yeah.
I think it was a really valuable experience. And something I'll take away for a long time.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. To find out more about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To give some feedback or suggestion for a future episode, go to the comments section on the website, or go to the blog and enter into the conversation.
So the first part of the trip, you guys were actually in Davis, home to UC Davis, known for its sort of progressive politics in the city itself. And you were there looking kind of more at urban geographies and looking at how, in some ways, I think, what the bicycle fit into the city and how the urban planning has embraced the bicycle. And so what kind of things did you learn there?
Well, one of the days when we were in Davis, we actually got to ride around town on our bikes with the city planner there.
All right.
And we rode around for a couple of hours, and we were really, and he just kind of showed us all these little spots that he's fought for, like widening bike lanes or getting like cars to have to move over for bikes and crosswalks. And he just kind of talked about like how much of a process it is for getting all these little changes in the city of Davis that people really just take for granted, and how much of an effort it is.
Like in terms of, did he give it a sense of how many years it took to actually have it look like that?
We were fortunate enough on this trip to spend the better part of a full day with Steve Tracy, who has been living in Davis since the early 1970s, working as a planner and an urban geographer, and was very much present when Davis, what California became the first American community to put a bike lane in, and dealing with a lot of the political debates and arguments in the city and how to really revisit how the city was organized and the model at which Davis would function and grow and exist under. And Steve Tracy was able to really talk to us a lot about the projects and the fights, and he made a point to say he's fought for every inch of bike lane in the city, and now we look at Davis, California, as really one of the better success stories of a city that has embraced bicycles as part of its identity.
So you spent maybe 2.5 or 3 days in Davis, and obviously you mentioned you went around with the city planner and saw about how bike lanes and how hard that fight is to get those on the landscape. A couple of other stops you had. One was at the Village Homes, and that's, you mentioned, kind of on the outside of the city. What can you tell us about that?
The Village Homes is a really uniquely designed community where it's basically connected through bike paths and walking paths, and the backs of homes are all facing the parking and streets. So if you were to just drive through it, you wouldn't really be seeing what's actually happening in the community. And the way that it works is the backside is parking and streets, and the front side, all the houses face each other, and in between the houses are their front yards and walking paths. And so it's kind of like this, it's designed in a very different way than any other community, because it's all intended for people to be walking or biking and having interactions with one another in kind of like a slow pace, kind of.
So
and
don't...
they have.
No, I was just going to say, it sounds like by design, it's sort of boxing out the car and kind of reintroducing that common space, which so often in housing kind of communities is a parking lot, right? And the space for
It was actually, it was very interesting to hear Steve, who was the guy who was leading us around, talk about it, because when you're there, it seems so natural and awesome and community-oriented and safe for kids and fun for adults, and you have access, you know, you can go from a house to, you know, a field and never see a car, you know, you can go out, you can go to schools, you can go to any community center and never have to be in a dangerous or risky situation. And to see that and see how well it works and see that actually economically it's really functional, like the price per square foot of those houses is comparable, if not, I believe he said it was 5 to 10% higher than the rest of the houses in Davis. And for that to be true and for it still to be a radical idea was pretty mind-boggling. You know, if you had seen it, you'd just see that it works so well.
Yeah.
And to know that it works on all levels and still have it be revolutionary is kind of mind-blowing. And that we have the opportunity to recreate that in so many different places as, you know, the urban sprawl continues and urban growth continues. And that idea is radical, though so, you know, functional.
Did Davis need to have bike lanes before that would be possible? And did you ever, did that ever kind of cross your minds or come into your discussions is, you know, what helps the other kind of come about? And I'm assuming this community you're talking about has come post 1970s and after the bike lanes had started, even the very first one, but now I'm sure it's a huge network. But is there a sense that a city needs to become bike-friendly first before you can have a community like that?
I think something that was very interesting that we heard about when we were traveling by bike with Steve Tracy around Davis and getting his perspective about this, you know, multiple decades of progress the city has made was that one of the main starting points for Davis and the advocates, the bicycle advocates there, was to say the way we need to start this is by thinking of the kids first, our young kids in the city first. And the way that the bike lanes and these bike-friendly neighborhoods and the village homes, which is tagged as an edible suburban community, were established was the first cycle path or bicycle highway was planned and built through the city. And the way that it worked wasn't to connect the downtown and wasn't to connect bars and restaurants and office parks, but it rather created a path that connected all of the schools in the school district in the city. So the elementary school was connected to the middle school, to the high school, and now Davis boasts the highest percentage of ridership to elementary school of any city in the United States. So it's looking at where do you start to sort of get the ball rolling on bike advocacy, and it was really with kids, and that was a really interesting piece that we learned in Davis.
That is quite, because most of, not most, but a lot of cities maybe trying to embrace a bike lane is probably much more connected to, like you're saying, the downtown gentrified sort of consumer places of consumption, and it's to connect them to those. And it's not always something much more functional than, like you're saying, like a school, connecting schools, probably saving money on than buses, right? Which is a huge expense for a lot of school districts.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
The name of the show is Geographical Imagination. And the reason I wanted to ask you guys on the show and to talk about this project is because my guess is that it's very much informed and perhaps changed. And Seth has been using the word radical. And I wonder how much this radically or potentially would you say, or how much would you say this is, I don't know, expanded your geographical imagination. And by that, I mean just the way you see the world. And maybe that's because you were on the bike and the speed of the bike made you see the world a little bit differently. But I think it's much more than that. And I'm hearing all these little stops that you made, none of which are really little, but these half-day stops that really kind of piece together maybe a complex sort of network. And so my question, I guess, to you guys is, how much do you think a trip like this for yourself or for anybody, other students, how much a trip like this really challenged the way you thought about the globe, the country, Sonoma Valley, California, and then really reshaped that thinking?
I think it really changed the way I looked about California, especially.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think out of all the states in the country, California is one of the more progressive and has opportunity or potential for improving their like bike infrastructure. I think it was really interesting to see like riding around how easy it is to go out into the world just with a bike and be able to really go wherever you want. And I think it's just only a matter of time till other people in California and in the country begin to realize this and potentially, you know, shift into a more slow movement.
Yeah. So you felt a certain autonomy, perhaps, on the bicycle that you might not in a car?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. How about you, Hannah?
Yeah. This trip kind of changed my perspective on what allows a community to become bike-oriented. Because before, I always thought that towns and places weren't bike-friendly simply because the weather wouldn't allow it, or they were too spaced out, or things like that. But going into places like Davis and seeing these bike-friendly communities, you see that it's a culture. And people have to support that culture and demand it of their community. And seeing that, I realized that a lot more places could be like this, but the mindset of people has to change. They have to want to be part of this bike culture. And we really were asking ourselves, how can a place change? How can the community want that?
Yeah, and it's, I'm sure, from maybe the different people you spoke to, see how complicated that process of change really might be. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. And they had to fight for every little inch of bike space.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. And lastly, and very briefly, I'd like to share that here in Salzburg, a group of adventurous human geography students, 12 of them to be exact, embarks each month on an expedition throughout the city, sometimes guided by me, sometimes self-guided, where they need to ask questions and relate our textbook concepts to the urban landscape and ground truth what they are learning theoretically. Each of the expeditions is designed to deepen student engagement with the themes from each of the 7 major units of our AP Human Geography course. Students document each of these 7 expeditions with photographs, maps, notes, and short writings. Students share their findings with the public by publishing them to an online blog set up for this purpose. And it is in this that I think we really take the step from just doing classroom work and lecturing and being able to respond and repeat, perhaps, the different ideas that we learn in the classroom to beyond that, to actually implementing them in our practices and using them to then further inform our geographical thinking, or as we call here, our geographical imagination, and continuing this process of understanding the structures of space and place that inevitably inform the way we live our lives. We end tonight on a solemn note. Our first guest, Professor Doreen Massey from Open University, has recently passed away, and we dedicate this episode to her for taking a chance on a show that had no record or no archive or nothing to show for itself. And she joined us in conversation about the geographical imagination. And we end with her words tonight.
It's the kind of implicit imagination of the world that we carry around with us, mental images of the world we live in. It can be all kinds of things and at all scales. I mean, it might just be about the other end of the road being the bad end of the road. It could be an image of another country. It could be something much more wide-ranging. But it's a kind of implicit picture of how we think about the world. And it can occur in all kinds of situations. And I want to argue that it's very important that we examine the pictures that we do carry with us about the world that we live in, because they have effects upon the way in which we act.